Welcome back to Topical Currents, substituting for Bonnie Berman. I'm Richard Ives. In the current political climate, Americans feel alienated from politics, and those who are engaged feel alienated from each other. The necessity for liberals and conservatives to find common ground in order to advance the common good has never been greater. Joining me today to promote the prospects for and cite some examples of what he calls convergence is author, attorney, political activist, and four-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader. His latest book is entitled Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Ralph Nader joins us from his office at the Center for Study of Responsive Law in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Ralph.
Thank you very much.
Happy to have you with us today, and I want to just begin by having you give us your assessment of the state of our republic, particularly in regards to how it relates to what you've written about in Unstoppable.
Well, as you know, there are a lot of headlines about gridlock in Washington, polarization of the people, red state, blue state, conservative, liberal, and there are serious disagreements, obviously, but there are also very serious agreements. And the agreements don't get the media play. They don't get on the politician's table during election time. They don't get discussed. And so I wrote this book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State, to highlight the areas of agreement. We all know the areas of disagreement. They disagree, for example, on reproductive rights, left-right. They disagree on gun control. They'll disagree on school prayer. They'll disagree on constitutional amendment for a balanced budget. But look at the areas, Richard, where they agree on. Increasingly, majorities, left-right, are very upset with what they call crony capitalism, corporate welfare, the diversion of huge taxpayer dollars to fund, subsidize, bail out Wall Street and other corporations that are mismanaged and get into hot water. They agree on doing something about corporate managed trade agreements that are shipping jobs and industries to autocratic regimes abroad, weakening our economy and weakening family income. They agree that something has to be done to stop eminent domain taking people's homes and then giving it over to corporations like Pfizer or even gambling casinos. They agree that something's got to be done about these tax escapes to the Bahamas or to other tax havens around the country, the world, for corporations, some of which are making billions of dollars in U.S. profits, paying zero federal income tax, like General Electric, Verizon, and others over recent years. And they agree that there should be strong law and order, crackdown on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse. Who doesn't see that every day if they don't read the Wall Street Journal, which has it almost every day? These are violations of the rights of investors, of consumers, of workers, of small taxpayers. Very, very serious corporate crime wave around the country because there aren't enough prosecutors, aren't enough investigators at the state and federal level to enforce existing laws. So you can see that even in the area at the state legislative level, we're seeing left-right alliances for minimum wage restoration. If you restore the minimum wage, that is, you adjust for inflation, from 1968 to now, the minimum wage would be $10.90 an hour. It's $7.25 an hour federal. So that's coming in at 70 to 80% support, which means it's conservatives and liberals believe in that justice of restoring the minimum wage, which would help 30 million workers who are now working in fast food and Walmarts and others for less money than workers earned in 1968, inflation adjusted.
Well, your book certainly is optimistic in tone in terms of what you're trying to get across. And if there's any one word that describes the central theme of Unstoppable, it's convergence. And so what is convergence in the context of its use in Unstoppable?
Well, it starts with public opinion. In other words, you say, oh, okay, is there a left-right alliance in the minds of people? You say, yeah, it's emerging. It's emerging now on trying to do something about the existing war on drugs, which seems to be backfiring and very costly, especially long sentences for teenagers caught with a little street drug, and they are put away for years. Already 15 legislatures have changed that, shortened those sentences, juvenile justice reform it's called, and that could only happen because left-right legislators got together on common ground. So it starts with public opinion. The next stage, when the public opinion congeals more visibly and starts moving operationally, that is, it starts getting press, it starts getting some allies among elected political officials. The third stage is when it gets regularly on the table of competing candidates for public office, local, state, national. They start talking about it instead of ignoring it. And then the final stage is when there's actual enactment. There's legislation. And what we've seen in Washington recently is some very key bills that pass only because of left-right support, like the Whistleblower Protection Act of 2013. That only passed because of left-right support in the Congress against very powerful corporate lobbyists who don't want to give more rights to federal employees who blow the whistle on how they defraud the government, like defrauding Medicare or defrauding military contracts.
Well, and yet the Obama administration, as has been noted, has prosecuted more people on whistleblowing charges than any other administration, in at least in recent memory. How do you align those two differences?
Well, it's the difference between giving federal employees the rights to take their conscience to work and blow the whistle, and some employees blowing the whistle on what the Obama administration thinks are state secrets, and that is often in dispute, of course. So, in other words, it's a general right now under federal law that you can blow the whistle on outside fraud on the taxpayer, like Medicare and military contracts. But if you blow the whistle on, say, the NSA or other intelligence agencies, the employee doesn't have that kind of legal protection and is very vulnerable to Obama and his Justice Department charging them with violating the old Espionage Act that was enacted back over about 100 years ago.
Well, returning to civic engagement, in the introduction to Unstoppable, you say that years spent in our educational system, our culture, and our political structures nurture a sense of powerlessness from a young age. How so, and is this intentional?
Well, one can call it institutional instinct, that we all know that schools, teachers, principals, they don't like controversial subjects, and if you bring the students down to study City Hall, or if you bring the students to make price comparisons between named supermarkets for consumer benefit, if you teach students about junk food and how bad some of this is and how to see propaganda in the advertisements beamed to them on television, that could get a school in hot water because the local business interests or the national business interests with local stores, chains, will object. So what happens is that the schools learn to hunker down. And so we learn myths about marketplace that don't occur. We never learn about corporate crime. And we certainly don't learn about the role of corporate control right down to the children's with the commercials beaming to them, bypassing, undermining parental authority, and selling them junk food, junk drink, violent programming, and all the rest of it. And so that does not bode well when these youngsters grow up. They are not given civic experience in the schools, tying the schools to the community under adult supervision. Civics is often taught in a memorization, you know, like our government has three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial. It's not taught in terms of experience. So the youngsters do not really grow up to see that democracy requires work, and that means themselves, and they have to involve themselves in local town council meetings, get out to vote, and on Congress and at the state level. So what this book, Unstoppable, is designed to do is to get people really thinking about how easy it is to turn the country around, and how historically, and I give a lot of historic successes, less than 1% of the people spread out around the country, say in congressional districts, rolling up their sleeves and promoting a reform or a direction that's more just for people in the country, and I have a lot of examples in the book, they win if they are representing what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment, what we call today public opinion.
Yes, in fact, I wanted to ask you about that, because with regards to convergence and what you just commented on or referred to, Lincoln's calls the public sentiment, you contend that we are all basically looking for the same things. It's just the means to attaining them where we differ. Is that correct?
Yes, and the more you get down to where people live, work, and raise their families, the less the means to attain them is treated in ideological general terms, and the more it's treated in terms of people's sense of fair play and their sense of confronting the common reality every day that they need to overcome. So when you get down to where people live, work, and raise their families, the attitude tends to be less ideological on a lot of these issues. Like, you go to Walmart, you can see conservative and liberal workers, right? Well, you're not going to see conservative workers say, you know, I've got two kids and I want to stay at $8 an hour because I'm conservative. See, they say, no, I want to work full time, and if you work full time, you shouldn't live in dire poverty. You should at least get the wages that Sam Walton had to pay his workers back in 1968, adjusted to inflation, which would be $10.90. That would raise the wages of about 1 million Walmart workers today, just to get back to where it was in 1968. So, and I think that's true for a lot of issues at the local level, whether it's decent public transit, clean air, clean food, clean drinking water, whether it's getting town hall to be more responsive, more open, less secret. Look at the left-right alliance against secret government, for heaven's sake. It's overwhelming. But what people have to do is take this level of converging public opinion and make it operational politically for victory. That's what this book's about.
Well, and we all know, or at least a good many of us know, your background as a champion of consumer rights and your anti-corporatist approach to politics. And I wanted to get your take on corporatism, as it's referred to, or corporate statism. And how do you think, does that benefit from our political divisiveness?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, for thousands of years, rulers rule in large part by dividing and ruling. And by dividing left-right on the areas they disagree and distracting all the media and all the political attention to those areas, and they fight it out every day, it takes away from focusing on areas where they do agree. And the important thing about where they agree, Richard, and this is very important, is they agree fundamentally on a lot of democratic procedures. For example, they believe they agree on open government. They agree on clean elections. Left-right agrees on giving voters more choice and voice by having more candidates and multi-parties on the ballot, whether it's libertarian or green. Whether they vote for them or not is another thing, but they want more choices on the ballot. They agree that taxes should be equitable and not skewed in favor of the powerful and the wealthy and the big multinational corporations. That's a lot to agree about. And I think that when you see the divide and rule being greased by campaign cash, I mean, it's actually, the more they fight it out on the areas that divide left and right in Washington, the more money they make from the contributors on one side or the other. In the meantime, the country's heading for the drifting downward on one indicator after another, more child poverty, for example. Housing is not in good shape, for example. We're not rebuilding and repairing America to community level. Schools, bridges, sewage, water systems, libraries, community clinics, ports, harbors, airports, they're all in dire need of repair, And instead of blowing apart Afghanistan or Iraq and trillions of dollars there, the money should come back home to repair America. And you will get 80 to 90%, including the local chambers of commerce, behind that kind of bring home those tax dollars to rebuild America and create jobs that are good pay and can't be exported to China. So you see areas of huge agreement, but we have to recognize that the power brokers don't want to see that. They want the divide and rule because it's to their advantage.
So I guess it's fair to say then that, yes, political differences, in your opinion at least, are manipulated by those powerful interests to serve their agenda. And
yes, very much so. And, you know, I have a lot of evidence in the book, but you don't need evidence. You just read the newspapers and look at the news, such as it is. The vast majority of it concentrates on the areas of disagreement, and the areas of agreement aren't even on the politicians' table. I mean, it's exceptionally clear to people when you start this kind of discussion, and I'm glad to see the book is being discussed all over the country. It's exceptionally clear to them that there are areas of common ground that are not being reflected in the political system or in the media, unless this common ground goes from public opinion into operational action.
So how does the use of political labels impair convergence?
How does the use of what?
Political labels such as, you know, left, right, conservative, liberal, Tea Partyist, however you want to define somebody politically.
What I say to them, look, keep your labels in the areas where we disagree on A, B, C, D issue, but start talking about where, even with your labels, you agree on W, X, Y, Z issues. And so you have the Tea Party, for example, they don't like crony capitalism. The progressives and liberals, many of them, they don't like corporate welfare, and they're the same thing with different names, that's all. Corporate welfare, the subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts, is called crony capitalism by people on the right.
If you don't recognize the voice, and I think you, most of our listeners would, we're speaking with author, attorney, political activist, and four-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader about his new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And Ralph, we're coming up on a break soon, but I want to just have you address how the convergence that we lack in the public domain, at least in public discourse, political discourse, is manifested in our political system.
Well, you can see it in Congress on a number of issues. For example, there's a left-right convergence starting to build on the renewal of the Patriot Act, and it's been rubber-stamped for renewal twice, but both left-right, people like Ron Paul and people like Alan Grayson, they think that it's very restrictive of our freedoms and civil liberties, and it ought to be amended in that direction. We're seeing now a left-right emergence against empire, against wars of aggression overseas that are boomeranging against us. Al-Qaeda is metastasized in all kinds of countries. Now it has even more virulent offshoots. People are basically saying, what are we getting out of this? We're weakening our country. We're alienating a lot of people in the world because there are a lot of innocent people being killed as a result of the so-called war on terror. Over 1 million Iraqis have died, innocent Iraqis, in a country that never threatened us. So I can see more and more of this bubbling. Of course, Congress is the last to get the message of convergence left-right. And so when it does get it, and the pressure on federal minimum wage increase is increasing in Congress because they're getting left-right emails, left-right calls on this, when it does reach Congress, you know that it's getting close to victory.
Well, explain how you see the corruption of conservatism and its impact or an impairment on convergence.
Yeah, well, you see, I call it corporatism because I've never met a conservative who calls herself or himself a corporatist. But I've met a lot of corporatists who think big business should run our country, who call themselves conservatives for cover. And so I always make that distinction between conservatives and corporatists. And I outline conservative philosophers throughout history in my book, Unstoppable, which show that these philosophers have been grossly distorted by corporatist think tanks, like Adam Smith and Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises. I mean, Adam Smith wanted public works. He thought that workers should get a decent wage. He was against business combines and monopolies. He was one of the first people to blow the whistle on how business interests take over government regulation. Friedrich Hayek, who is the guru for Congressman Paul Ryan, he was against Medicare and Medicaid because it wasn't universal. He didn't like discriminatory health insurance. He wanted everybody to have what they called social insurance for health care. So when I go up on Capitol Hill and I talk to these people, I very clearly am able to discern, am I talking to a conservative or am I talking to a corporatist? Am I talking to a corporate Democrat or am I talking to a real progressive? Am I talking to a corporate Republican or am I talking to an authentic libertarian or conservative?
Well, I'm really appreciative that you put it in those terms because this is not a issue that certainly aligns with political parties entirely in terms of being just a Republican or Democrat or even conservative liberal issue.
Well, look at the evidence in the House, Richard. If President Obama brings the NAFTA steroids, the so-called Pacific Trade Agreement, to the House for rubber stamping under fast-track procedure, no amendments allowed, minimal debate, he's going to lose because there is now a majority left-right members of the House in defiance of their own leadership, John Boehner, Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, Minority Leader. They're going to vote against fast-track. So you can see that left-right convergence bubbling up here and there, and it's important for people back home to show the members of Congress who is sovereign and who's going to be pulling the strings, namely the people, letting the politicians know where they stand.
Once again, we're speaking with Ralph Nader about his new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. We're going to take a short break now, Ralph, so stick with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Topical Currents. Substituting for Bonnie Berman, I'm Richard Ives, speaking today with Ralph Nader about his new book, Unstoppable. And before we go any further, I just want to give out our phone number for listeners who are interested to speak with Ralph about issues relating to this topic. And it's, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. And returning to the notion of convergence, Ralph, and it seems to rely on placing citizenship above party affiliation first and foremost, something that seems to be rather difficult these days for a lot of people. And with the level of political polarization as high as it is, do you think that the country is capable of reaching a critical mass, so to speak, when it comes to convergence?
Yeah, one victory will stimulate another. I think the minimum wage victory that's coming, it's already coming in many state legislatures who have increased it. They're not waiting for Washington. Even some cities like Seattle, San Jose, California, Santa Fe, New Mexico are substantially above the $7.25 per hour. And then that'll invigorate people because people's morale is down. They're discouraged. They feel powerless. They feel they can't fight the proverbial City Hall or Exxon Mobil or some health insurance company that's gouging them. And so I think that the purpose of this book, as I said again, is to show people through historical analogy as well as contemporary opportunity that it's easier than you think to turn this country around. Less than 1% active citizens, for example, in congressional districts representing majority public opinion, can do it. It was done again and again. I mean, look at women's suffrage, the women's right to vote. Look at the labor improvements over the years. Look at the environmental movement, the consumer movement more recently. It's less than 1% of the people are active, but they're championing avenues of justice and fair play that are supported by a majority, and the politicians put their finger to the wind and they start shaping up.
Well, change can be a loaded word in politics and is a term more often associated with the left than the right, I think. How much does convergence rely on the ability to change, and to what degree, if any, does that pose a greater challenge for those on the right?
That's a very insightful question, actually. The best areas of convergence in terms of victory are things that left-right want to oppose and stop. It's more difficult to get left-right to propose something that's changing from the status quo. But it's important to stop things. It's important to stop empire. It's important to stop corporate welfare. It's important to stop abuses of our civil liberties. It's important to stop ongoing pollution. But to rearrange the use of the federal budget, for example, by requiring the Department of Defense to audit itself. It just doesn't audit itself. It's only half of the federal budget's operating expenditure. You know, it's $800 billion, include the Iraq and Afghanistan military budgets. It isn't even audited. They can't provide the Government Accounting Office of Congress with the data year after year that can permit the GAO or the Government Accounting Office to audit the Pentagon. Okay, so that's going to be a little more difficult because that's going to expose the huge waste and corruption in the military contracting system, the redundancy of weapons systems in a world without the Soviet Union anymore. It's going to expose that. So that's going to be a harder turnaround. But to say no, stop, don't do what you're doing, that's easier than to say, here are changes that have got to be made from now what you're doing, so you're not going to do it the same old way. If you get what I mean, there's a difference. For example, 90% of people in this country want to break up the big New York banks that are considered too big to fail. They don't want another crash on the backs of workers and taxpayers coming out of Wall Street. That has not gone operational. That is not even on the table of politicians running for election or re-election. See, that hasn't, because that requires a change, a major change in the antitrust laws. However, you know, a lot of good things can happen by stopping bad things.
Well, I'm going to bring some of our listeners into the conversation, Ralph. So we're going to go to Noah in Deerfield first. Hello, Noah.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Ralph, I have a question for you concerning the invasion at the Mexican border. We're being swamped and overwhelmed. The government isn't doing anything. As a man of the left, what would you do to protect the jobs of all these poor Americans who are competing with the Central Americans for slave wages?
Well, as I've said again and again, I'm going to answer your question very specifically, but first a general comment. Historically, our military and foreign policy towards Central and South America has been to support dictators and oligarchs who oppress their people, who get very desperate and head north. Historically, we had a trade agreement called NAFTA that dumped cheap tax-subsidized corn into Mexico, displacing a million corn farmers and their families from
the
land.
Yes, but the situation we have now,
some of them headed up north. So,
yeah, but don't you think we should close the borders and send all these people home?
Yeah, I was going to say, always keep that in mind, Noah, the general policy that has to be changed is the cause of this. Because if they had prosperous economies, most people don't want to leave their native country and leave their families in order to get a few dollars to feed them. Now, on the second thing, we have to control our borders. I don't agree with the Wall Street Journal, who wants basically open borders, open immigration. We need to protect the wage level in this country. We need to deal with smuggling. We need to deal with pollution overflow, like air pollution, etc., and we do it over into Mexico, and they do it over into our country. But we have to control our borders.
Yeah, but you'll agree with me.
Because if we don't, we're not only going to get gangs and the drug war spilling over, we're going to get downward pressure on the already low-wage economy that millions of Americans have to suffer from.
Yeah, but you'll agree with me that most people on the left have nothing to say about this. They're in favor of this wave of illegal immigration.
No, you're sort of getting us off topic here. We have a program tomorrow that's going to be addressing this matter in more specific terms. It's something you'll want to tune into at 1
Thank
o'clock.
Thank you very much.
All right.
And, Thank you very much.
We'll look for your call tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right. Ralph, let's get back to what we're talking about before Noah's call, and I think Dave will bring us back on track. Hello, Dave. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Dave here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Mr. Nader, thank you very much for all you've done for our country. I do feel, however, that what you're talking about has a lot to do with people's wages, their earning power, etc., and I believe what happens in the private sector and the public sector are related. I myself am a public sector worker. I know many public sector workers, some of who are very dear and near to me, who have benefited from more liberal labor policies in this country, and at the same time did not join a union, got all the union benefits, and have voted for people who are basically making life difficult, more difficult for me as a public sector worker. I wonder, how do you bring this class of people around to a more reasonable and centrist point of view? And thank you for taking my call, and I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Well, I hope I understood your question, but if it dealt with, should workers in public agencies that are unionized be able to get the benefits of the union contract with the agency without being a member of the union and without paying union dues if they refuse to do so? Well, I think they should be free not to be a member of the union, but I think they have to pay union dues. Otherwise, what you'll do is get the free rider idea, and you'll undermine the very opportunity for collective bargaining by public employee unions.
Okay, and now to Willie in Boca Raton. Hello, Willie, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I guess, it always, whenever I hear Mr. Nader, who my dad, just loved, and I respected him a lot too, his strategy and his thinking, convergence, what's politics, strategy, that's all very interesting. But I go back to, I look at the Supreme Court now, and I look at the aftermath of the Iraq War, and I look at Mr. Nader, and I just think maybe he should have put the party or the country or whatever you want to call it ahead, and shouldn't have been running in 02, should have been advocating for his causes, but not been out there running with his star power, which was just enough to throw the state that I'm in Republican, and we all know what happened after that. So as much as I respect what you're saying, bad strategy.
Yeah, really, you're sort of drifting off topic too. But Ralph, that's something that I've heard from some people when I mentioned that we were going to speak with you today, and so I'll give you an opportunity to address that reasoning, if I can call it that, from people who object to your having run for president.
First of all, we all have an equal right to run for public office. That means that either we're all spoilers of one another, trying to get votes from one another, or none of us are spoilers. I don't believe a Libertarian candidate or a Green Party candidate is a second-class citizen. But the caller went deeper than that. I don't think he challenged this principle I just enunciated. He said it's bad strategy. Well, put yourself in my place. I'm in Washington trying to represent a change for occupational health and worker damage and disease. I'm trying to fight the polluters, trying to get a fair shake for consumers, healthcare area. I'm trying to do something about hospital malpractice. And both parties ignore it year after year after year because they're dialing for the same commercial campaign contributions. So what do you do if you're in my place? You listen to Thomas Jefferson.
Hold on,
Willie. You listen to Thomas Jefferson.
Willie, hold on,
and
Willie.
Let me finish. The more important thing, and I'll get right to the core, there are about 15 sine qua nons that dumped George Bush in the White House. One of them was the Electoral College, because, as you know, Gore won the popular vote by 500,000 votes. In most countries, you don't come in first in the popular vote, and the guy who comes in second wins the office. So there are about 15 sine qua nons, and Al Gore, if he was on this program, would say it wasn't the Green Party. It was what happened in Florida, from the Secretary of State to the governor to the shenanigans on the ballot design, which the Democratic Party in those three southern counties approved, the butterfly design, and the corrupt decision by the Supreme Court. Not to mention, as Al Gore has bewailed, he lost his home state in Tennessee. If everything happened the way it did in 2000, and he had won the state of Tennessee, he'd have been president. So
okay,
you shouldn't.
Fair enough. You defended yourself very well, and as I say, I respect you a lot. So could I phrase it a little differently? If you knew that that little bit of chance that Ralph Nader would have thrown the election in the tightest election in history, or close to it, would you have had second thoughts about running at that point? Because I'm sure you didn't think that you would be the spoiler when you got in. I respect that.
Not even close. If I wasn't even in the race, Bush would have gotten more votes. We don't have time to cite you all the studies, but basically, by counterattacking against the Greens, the Democratic Party pulled out a lot of votes that they wouldn't have pulled out. By the way, two-thirds of my votes, according to the Democratic pollster, after 2000... two-thirds of my votes would have either stayed home or voted for George W. Bush. 39% would have voted.
All right, Willie, let it go. Okay, Ralph. I just thought you needed to, sort of...
No, it's important.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
Because otherwise it stifles competition at election time. You cannot have that kind of political bigotry against small party candidates and blame them for all the ills of the electoral system and all the mistakes of the two major candidates over time.
Well, and as you point out, there are a whole host of reasons why your candidacy did not cost Al Gore the election in 2000, but some people just refuse to look at the numbers and listen to reason on that. Anyway.
And Al Gore agrees with this analysis.
Yes.
And he doesn't blame the Green Party because he knows what he could have prevented in retrospect, and become the president, but he couldn't overcome the Electoral College. You'd think there'd be as much denunciation of the Electoral College where someone can win the popular vote and lose the presidency.
Agreed. And so back to Unstoppable and what you were talking about previously on the program. You list 25 proposed redirections and reforms, as you refer to them, through Convergent Action, and you cited some already. Are there other ones that you think are particularly prominent and are already underway in a sense?
One is very prominent, but it isn't operational yet, and it comes in about 90%, and that is opposing the commercialization of childhood. That's where these companies on TV and elsewhere market their products directly to 7-6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, undermining parental authority and selling stuff that's very bad for them, that increases obesity, high blood pressure, childhood diabetes, and exposes them to all kinds of violent video programming. It's just repulsive. And I one time asked the CEO of one of these companies, would you ever show your own children these ads? He sort of laughed and he said, what do you think? Like, of course he wouldn't. Unfortunately, it hasn't gone operational. There are various parent groups that have spoken out. They've had conferences. They've condemned it. But I think we ought to go right to the core, which is the public airways are owned by the people of this country. They're the landlords. And the tenants of the radio and TV stations licensed by the Federal Communications Commission and they pay nothing 24 hours a day for this privilege of deciding who says what and who doesn't on public TV, on the public airwaves. And so I believe that there should be not censorship, but time on TV and radio to critique these crazed and brutal ads to kids and shame them into reconsideration.
Well, you mentioned the media, and of course, along with politicians and the 1%, how do they factor into the whole notion of convergence and its their role in that process?
Well, they're not very good on that. They tend to follow the fights of the politicians and the fights of corporations, and they report, you know, things like that. Just think of all the reporting over the years on the reproductive rights, for example. How about children dying from infections? How about children who are undernourished? You know, the country isn't split on that. The country was converging on that. But it would be nice to get some media more focused on it instead of on where the left and right disagree. I'm having trouble myself, Richard, getting on the Diane Reams show, the Terry Gross show, the Charlie Rose show, the show, Ashbrook show up in Boston. All these are public radio, public TV, and I can't get, for the last 10 years, I can't get this message on, it's easier than you think, folks, to turn the country around. Left, right, agree on a lot of things. That forges an unstoppable majority. Let's stop our dismay and our discouragement and our sense of powerlessness. I can't even get on those programs, Richard. I get on local public radio, Wisconsin, Texas, Connecticut, now Florida. I can't get on the national shows.
Well, I'm not sure what to say to that, Ralph, but I'm going to let Tricia have some words with you prior to, the end of the program, which is coming up soon. So, Tricia, please be brief and to the point. Hi. You're on the air, Tricia. Hi.
I'm an elected official in Bal Harbour Village, Florida. It's a coastal community right near Miami Beach. And I've been on for 5 years. And I find that it's really, really difficult, even in a community like ours, where it's a highly educated, generally affluent community. When I tell my neighbors, my friends, socially, come to the meeting. It's a really important issue we're being discussed. It'll affect everyone. The general reaction is like, oh, come on, please, I can't be bothered. It's all predetermined anyway. Politics is so corrupt. And I find myself, most of what I do is just trying to convince people that it's not, that if they would just show up, there could be change.
The central issue of our time. She is articulating the central issue of our time, which is the lack of civic motivation and sense of powerlessness, apathy, cynicism. It all plays in the hands of the ruling powers to get their way. You're in complicity when you drop out of democracy. You're not smart or clever when you say pox on all their houses, I'm just going to live my private life, because your private life is affected.
Exactly. And everybody says, it's not, as long as it's not in my backyard. And then I say, but folks, this is a participatory democracy. I'm not even a politician. I don't even, you know, I'm not a political career politician. But they don't, it's like, forget it. I'm not wasting my time.
Well, here's what I say. Show them the book. Have a book discussion with my book. You'll see the examples throughout history where a handful of people said nuts to that. We're going to get involved. It's our country. It's we the people that starts the Constitution. We're going to get involved. We're going to change it.
I'm really excited about this book, because I didn't even want to run for re-election because of this feeling of, like, you know, what's the difference? Nobody cares anyway. But now I'm going to read your book and hopefully be energized.
You know what we do? We show them the $2 bill. The picture on the $2 bill is a picture of the gathering of people who signed the Declaration of Independence, and the title under the dollar bill is, aren't you glad these people showed up? Against the most powerful military force in the world, King George's army?
That's the way to go.
And then you can just go to the six women who got together in 1846 and started the women's right to vote movement. Aren't we glad they showed up? So, look, quitting is not supposed to be in the American tradition. It's not in the athletic tradition, and it shouldn't be in the civic tradition. And get those teachers to start teaching the youngsters civic skills and civic history.
Now, and you make, a very valid and worthwhile point, Ralph, in this conversation, in letting people, or reinforcing the notion, at least in people who are of that mindset where they're alienated from politics and think that, you know, their involvement doesn't matter any longer. That indeed, it is. It's all up to them and us collectively. And isn't that
right.
What your book is about ultimately?
Yes, and one of the 24 areas of left-right convergence is community-rooted businesses. Credit unions, community banks, farmer-to-consumer markets, renewable energy, local renewable energy, community health clinics emphasize prevention. Every time you, the consumer, patronizes these businesses with your dollars, you're taking away dollars that you are now giving to Bank of America, to Pfizer, to hospital chains, to Exxon Mobil. You're taking dollars away from them, and therefore you're reducing their power. So there's a magazine called Yes from Seattle. It's called Yes, that's the title, magazine. And it, every time it comes out, it reports stories where these community-based businesses are flowering and they're expanding, including independent bookstores who have events for the community that the big chains can't emulate. And Yes Magazine is tremendously optimistic because it shows what's actually being done, not theory, not ideology. And I must say, when I go to farmer markets, Richard, I don't have to tell you that people who patronize farmer markets sometimes call themselves conservatives, libertarians, liberals, or progressives. Doesn't matter. They want that fresh food.
So in just 2 minutes or so we have left, Ralph, what do you want listeners, liberal and conservative, left, right, whatever persuasion they are politically, to take away from this discussion and from your book, Unstoppable?
I want them to have a discussion the way we just did at the Cato Libertarian Institute with left, right, in Washington, back in their living rooms, in their school auditoriums, wherever they can gather, get left, right together, and start laying out the areas that they can start this momentum from the local to the state to the national and change this country for the better fast. We're a country that is full of problems we don't deserve, but we have huge number of solutions on the shelf we don't apply because we're divided and ruled instead of getting together as this book proposes. This book does not sugarcoat the obstacles, but it's a very factually grounded book, historically, contemporaneously, and projecting better futures ahead for our children and grandchildren. If those discussions get underway, and they can spread rapidly through the internet, if those discussions on with my book Unstoppable as a launching point, you will see a bubbling up that will reach the politicians, local, state, and national, that now think that all they got to do is dial for campaign cash and run for election. They're going to have to stand for the people. And you want an autographed copy of the book, sometimes it gets people to read it more, you just go to nader.org, you get obtain an autographed copy of the book, and you can also sign up for my free weekly column. Every week you'll get a column from me electronically.
Well, I want to thank you, Ralph Nader, for joining us today. Maybe other NPR or programs and stations are not... permitting you to come on, but we certainly are glad that you came on with us today and want to thank attorney, author, political activist, and four-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader. His new book is Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And once again, Ralph, really appreciate both your time and your efforts.
Thank you, Richard. Thank Public Radio in South Florida, and thank your listeners. Let's go South Florida. It's easier than you think. Thank you.
Goodbye, Ralph. And that's Topical Currents for today. We hope you found it thought-provoking. Thanks to Paul Leary for technical supervision and Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, hope I pronounced that right, for taking your calls. Program information about today's program with a podcast is available at our website, WLRN.org. Just click on the radio button on the upper right-hand side of the page and scroll down to Topical Currents. You can also visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. She'll speak with investigative journalist Todd Miller, who's written about the militarization of our country's borders in his book, Border Patrol Nation: Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. That's Topical Currents tomorrow at 1. I'm Richard Ives. Make it a good afternoon, and remember, government embodies our collective efforts. It enables us to help one another. To that end, it should be supported, not dismantled. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.